And I believe I'm now live with Elisheba Johnson. Are you there?
Yes.
Hey.
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. I feel like you and I haven't spoken on or in any way in a long time, so we're going to catch up for our listeners today and get a feel of what you've been doing.
Yes, we went to high school together.
I know. Yeah, so that's our story. We went to high school together. Do we want to admit where we went to high school?
No, not at all.
We don't want to tell anybody. Yes. Oh man. I mean, we could really crack the vaults and just go back and tell all the terrible stories of that place that I don't miss in the slightest.
We'll leave that for, you know,
that'll be our next show. So for all the listeners that don't know you, let's talk about who is Elisheba Johnson. You are my favorite thing. You have a Facebook bio that says "Shy Arts Administrator Tries to Change the World." And I think that actually says a lot. So are you, would you still stand by, you are an arts administrator? Are you still shy? Are you still trying to change the world?
All three of those things are still very true.
Okay, cool. That's perfect. So what are you up to these days?
The short, like, cliff notes of my story is I went to art school, and then started an art gallery here in Seattle that was also a cafe called Fair Gallery Cafe.
Yes.
And I ran that for 6 years. And it was an interdisciplinary art space. I've really been interested in the power of art collectives, but also like going to a school like Cornish, which is the only interdisciplinary art school west of the Mississippi, of how visual artists, musicians, theater artists are all kind of germinating and creating together. So Fair was this space really inspired by Gertrude Stein, how she held space for the Dada movement in Paris, but like her apartment was just this place where like Hemingway hung out and Picasso, right? Like all these interdisciplinary artists that we know are super famous. And she was like this badass queer Jewish poet. And I think creating space for people to kind of come together is really important to me, and that's a through line in my work. So a year ago with some friends of mine, we started a project called Wanawari. It's situated in a fifth generation Black-owned home in the Central District, which is Seattle's historically redlined neighborhood that has experienced drastic gentrification and displacement. So the neighborhood at one time was like 80% Black, and now it's less than 10% Black. So it's really a kind of like a social practice project of looking at what does it mean to reclaim space for Black people. So we rent Inye Wakoma. My collaborators are Inye Wakoma, Jill Friedberg, and Rachel Kessler. But we rent Inye Wakoma's grandmother's house and give it back to the Black community as a Black arts and cultural center.
Wow.
So again, like there's visual art, music, dance, all those things kind of coming together and cross-pollinating. But it's also a pandemic.
Yeah.
A lot of things on.
Well, let's go back to Fair, because I bet right now I went to Fair, and if, for those who don't know, Fair was located where the pinball place is now. I can't remember
the pinball place is gone.
Oh, they gone too?
It's now a flower shop. Yeah.
It's what now? Oh, it's a barbershop?
A flower shop.
I would have liked a barbershop better. But okay, so it's a flower shop now. So it basically, I mean, when I went to Fair, the first time I went, I was like, okay, this, like, I can have coffee, I can have booze, I can look at art, I can have interesting conversations. It was like it was a melange of so many different, I mean, basically, it was a melange of you. It was so much who I know you as a person to be, Elisheba. It had all of your loves in it. Would you say that's accurate?
Thank you. Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's so...
Well, and maybe that's where the shyness comes into play, right? Like, it's so hard to meet people that I think maybe I naturally gravitate to creating spaces where people feel like they can meet people and belong. And Yeah. Not have to be extroverted.
No, I love that. And to be able to be busy. I mean, actually, I fully get that because, you know, I opened a bar and I felt like, what I realized is that I don't like going to bars that much, but I do like the feeling of them, and I like seeing people connecting, you know, but I don't really want to like connect. So it's like, you know, it's like, I love facilitating connections, but I don't always want to be like that person who's, you know, in the thick of it, I guess.
You can kind of, and I remember when you had your bar, you can orchestrate, right? Like, you're the host, right? You're the convener.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the convening
really powerful for that.
When Fair shut down, was that like a big disappointment, or were you happy, or you know, like, and what kind of a shift did that bring in your life when you closed Fair?
That's an interesting question. Still mourning the closing of Fair. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. One is that when Fair existed, it was 2006 to 2012, right? Which was a really interesting time now in history. So I somehow survived the dot-com crash and the economic collapse of 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. But that still actually was probably leading up to our demise. Like, I was able to kind of survive for a while afterwards, but it was pretty catastrophic. And I opened that space in Capitol Hill when it was still at the ends of being, you know, a really bustling outsider arts district. But I remember opening up and people saying, this neighborhood's changing and I'm moving to Ballard, which even sounds weird now.
Yeah. Ballard is, 'cause Ballard's even worse.
Yeah, right. Like, right. But at the time, that was more funky than what Capitol Hill was. And so now we've seen this resurgence of people really trying to reclaim the artistic space and preserve the artistic space of Capitol Hill and what that community has, because so many of the art spaces were disappearing, and the artists as well. And it just became a place for a lot of restaurants and bars, which, you know, is okay, but we need an equal balance. So it existed in this kind of time period. There was other art spaces too, or community spaces that were POC centric. Because Fair was POC centric. So there was like the Electric Tea Garden. There was Lucid, Jazz Bar, Punctuation was a gal. There was you could name a whole bunch. And so people come up to me literally once or twice a week and tell me that they miss the space that Fair held. So, you know, I think you look at now and there's just very few cultural spaces that that are kind of homegrown like that. I mean, Vermilion, thank God, still exists, which is an art bar on Capitol Hill.
Oh, I don't know.
But, you know, it's just, yeah, but it's harder.
Right, I mean. Even.
My rent.
Well, your rent was probably went from doable to awful I don't know what if it did when you said it closed in 2012. That's probably when it was just starting to, everything was just, because I know I came out here in like 2010 and I was like, oh God, I don't recognize Seattle anymore. I'm not going back. Yeah, it's like,
yeah, because I think when my rent started at like $1,500 and got up to like 18 something. And then the space was vacant after the pinball place left, and people were like, let's go back, start Fair again. And a friend looked up the rent, and it was over $3,000.
Sounds about right.
You know, doubled. And it's a really tiny space.
Yeah.
But so that doesn't make any sense.
It's true. The square footage is misleading because it's a really high ceiling place, and it has like a whole upper level. But yeah, very tiny, small square footage, and there's no way to do a kitchen, right? Like, there's no commercial kitchen in there, so you're just stuck serving drinks or serving flowers. But
exactly.
So you went to Cornish for painting, and you still are you still a practiced painter? Is that still something that you're doing with your life?
These are all good questions.
We're getting real today. We're talking to Elisheba Johnson, who is a shy arts administrator trying to change the world, small business owner, and creator of I would say sacred spaces for Black people. That's just for our listeners who are tuning in. But yeah, tell us about your painting then. give us the real dirt on your painting.
I kind of hung up my art career for a while, like running fair and all of that. It's just too much to do all that type of stuff and make art. But then I kind of picked everything back up about 2 years ago, restarted my art practice. More conceptual art, sculpture based. And then really moving into public art. So I have a practice where I have active public art commissions right now. I work with a collaborator, and then, which kind of goes into the, like the social practice, community-based engagement stuff. But I still do like to paint. I had a show of paintings a couple of years ago. So I like to still do that. I think it's all about finding time, when you're working all the time to like, you know, sit down and make work. But
right.
I think there's work that I need to make.
Yeah.
For sure.
Working and parenting and all of it. No escape.
Yeah.
No escape for you.
Yeah.
So when you worked for the, I remember it was so cool when you got that job working for basically the city, the Office of Arts and Culture in Seattle. And it sounds like you still have some holdovers from that job, but can you tell us a little bit about what you were doing and what you were learning about Seattle in general at that job in terms of the arts?
Oh yeah, I mean I was so excited to get that job, and I loved working there. I worked there for 6 years, and you know, like I feel like FAIR was like this microcosm of like me putting my personal resources into supporting the community. And I really wanted, I felt like now is the time to kind of jump into working into government and figuring out how to filter those resources into the community. And that's really what I did for 6 years. I worked with the Arts Commission for a while, which is the city's board, which has anything from working artists to executive directors to funders, you name it, lawyers. All really kind of thinking about what the Office of Arts and Culture should be doing policy-wise. So that was super interesting and fun. And then I moved into being a public art project manager and really thinking about how to diversify the field and working with people like Marsha Iwasaki, that just retired from that office after like 28 years. And really thinking, doing some capacity building programs, getting some folks, younger folks, artists new to the field, people of color, women, queer folks into the public art realm.
That's great. Yeah. So in that work, I guess, you know, generally, like, how did you find, do you think Seattle has done a good job of representing, you know, artists of color, Black artists, queer artists? Has there been support for those groups, from the city of Seattle and from the Arts Commission and the like?
I think the city is doing a really good job. I mean, especially under Randy Engstrom, the current director's tutelage, like, he's really passionate about equity, and the people there have, like, they keep recreating their programs to think about how they can be more equitable and diverse. There is always more work to do, because we all know that structures are inherently racist the way they were built, right? So there's going to be ways that it's just impossible for people to get in. But I think they're actually really doing really good work. That said, back to, you know, the affordability thing. I mean, Seattle used to be this place where people moved here and you could, like, be a barista and be a full-time, you know, in a band full-time, and you could exist, right? And have an apartment and go out to eat. And now it's so expensive that people, by and large, are giving up their art practices, whatever that practice is, so that they can just survive. And I feel like kind of what you were saying when you said you moved back in 2010, it's like the whole city's been, like, sanitized with these, like, cookie-cutter buildings. Like, all our cool, funky buildings have gone away, and all our cool, funky people are going away, too, right? They're being displaced out of the city. And I think we're at this critical moment where Seattle's really needs to fight for what our identity is and who we want to be. Do we want to be like Silicon Valley, or do we want to kind of go back to who we are?
Right.
And that's a question for, like, you know, city legislature, you know, council and people in power, and then for us to, you know, the residents to rise up and put pressure on, you know, which is happening. I think there's a lot of people right now fighting for the Seattle that they think this should be.
Mm. Well, I really want to get into Wanawari after we do a little musical break, but I did read on the websites on your description for the project, Seattle's Central District was 80% black in the 1970s. Today, it is less than 14% black. And that is, you know, I mean, that's a striking, it's a striking number.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's all, I mean, it's all connected to belonging and all the things that we were talking about, right? Like, this kind of, Seattle's become more homogenous, and I've watched it as I've, you know, I've lived here my entire life and never left.
Yeah.
So, that's disappointing, right? Because nobody wants to live in a place that doesn't have, cultural, you know, diversity, I think. Yeah,
well, I got a lot more questions.
We can talk more about that.
Oh, we're going to talk more about that in just a second. I've got a lot more questions, and we're talking to Elisheba Johnson, shy arts administrator trying to change the world, or actually changing the world, and also member of the executive cohort of something called. Do you say Wanawari or Wana? How do you say it? What's the right way to say it?
You said it right. Wanawari.
Wanawari. So. Can you tell our listeners about Wanawari, what it is, and how you started it with your cohort, I guess?
Yeah. So, like I said, the four of us had been working together, Inye Wakoma, Rachel Kessler, and Jill Friedberg, working on an actual project in the Central District for the city of Seattle. And we knew we wanted to continue working together. And we had a really good working relationship. And so we were starting to unpack what it would mean to actually rent Inye's grandmother's house. So we banded together. And
his grandmother no longer lived there, I'm guessing.
She no longer lives there. She lives in one of the other properties. So I should go back a little bit.
No, it's okay.
So Inye's family has lived in the Central District for 5 generations. They own that home for 5 generations.
Wow.
His grandmother and grandfather... bought the home in 1951. So they bought the house next door, which Inye now owns and lives in. And then this house was always a rental property to his great aunt. And then after she passed away, the home has just been a rental property to people that he finds that are appropriate renters. But it's really important for their family to keep the homes that they have left, the one that his grandmother's living in, and this home, the Wanawari house. Because they had at one time 6 houses in the Central District, and now they're down to 3.
Mm.
And so this is kind of an economic pressure that a lot of black families are experiencing, where, you know, parents had homes in, you know, historically redlined neighborhoods. Those neighborhoods then start to become gentrified. Property taxes go up. Different family members may not want to buy the home. They have their own homes, et cetera, right? And those homes get sold. But then there's kind of, and then that's kind of some of the ways that community has been displaced. So it's vitally important to the family to keep the house. A lot of other families are in a similar situation. So this is really an art project, a social practice project, looking at how maybe art can keep, help people keep their homes, right? So we rent it. It's a black art center. We have, like I said, visual arts, performing arts, poetry, you name it. So people can come and experience the space, and then it's also a hub. So when black folks come back into the community, there's also black folks in the community still, right?
Yeah.
So they have a place that is for them, by them, looks, you know, and is representative of the ideas that they're interested in having a dialogue about, right?
Yeah.
So this neighborhood is also changing very quickly, as it's a test case almost nationwide for gentrification, but there's these really incredible community-led projects like the Liberty Bank building that was a building. Liberty Bank was the first black bank west of the Mississippi. And then it turned into Key Bank, but it was always intended that if that property wasn't a bank, to go back into community for the land to go back into the community. So when Key Bank closed, a lot of people advocated for it to be a community space. Africatown partnered with what is now called Community Roots, and they developed, I think, a 90-apartment building. So 80% of the residents are African-American. And then there's some other projects that are kind of like a right-to-return project, where if people can prove that they have historic roots to the Central District, they can move into those apartments. So I've been saying, you know, the Central District looking forward isn't going to be a historically redlined neighborhood, but it will be a multicultural neighborhood. And it was before. It was always Jewish and Japanese. And so what, you know, it's important to have arts institutions that are reflective of all the different people in that community.
Yeah,
it's an exciting time to have an art center there again.
Can you provide any, like, and no pressure if you don't know the specifics, but the historical context of the Central District, especially considering it was 80% Black people living there in the 70s, you know, and talked about redlining, which is a shady real estate practice, where you basically, you know, force Black people to live in a certain neighborhood, or that's steering. Redlining is... God, there's so many. The thing is, there's so many racist real estate practices, and they all relate to segregation and what's the gentrification. I mean, so Central District, for people who are Port Townsend residents or Jefferson County residents and don't ever go to Seattle, and I don't blame you right now. That's not true. I love Seattle. I still love you, Seattle. Sorry about that. But like, because I think that there's some context to, especially, you know, when you grow up in the north end of Seattle, you're like, where are all the Black people? And, you know, growing up, you know, most people were over in the Central District, you know, so is that a result of segregation? You know, what's the historical context of the Central District, so we can understand how restoring it is very important?
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, I am not a scholar on this by any means, so I'm going to preface that by anything that I say. There are people who have studied this and really, you know, understand it in deep, deep ways. So I'm giving more of a cliff note.
That's good. That's all we need.
Of exactly. But yeah, so, you know, exactly what you said, right? Redlining, you know, is a housing practice that basically meant that the Central District was one of the only places in town, I think, you know, South Seattle and other places, where Black folks were actually allowed to buy property, right? And there was like a red line literally on a map that was where they were. So that's where, so then there became a concentrated amount of Black folks there. But, you know, even if you go further back to that land, that neighborhood was actually traditionally, like I said, Jewish and Japanese. And during the Japanese internment, Japanese folks were taken, right? They lost their homes. And then, you know, a lot of Black folks sometimes bought those homes, right? So there's kind of this history that is steeped in white supremacy around land and who can live where, that is complicated and uncomfortable. And it's necessary to understand all of that history. But when you have a large amount of people living in one neighborhood, then what also happened was an incredible cultural exchange, right? So you have the Jackson Street Jazz, which is nationally known, right? We have people like Ray Charles that was here and Ernestine Anderson, right? And so there was all these jazz clubs up and down Jackson Street. And you wouldn't be able to have something like that unless you had a community that was kind of close-knit and together. You have the Jimi Hendrix, right, and all this incredible music that came out of Seattle that we're known for, that is kind of a byproduct of this, you know, really screwed up, like, housing practice. So as there was, like, an incredible theater, the festivals, the Mardi Gras Festival that became the Black Community Festival, all these things that you look at the history that was able to kind of happen because people were together. There was radio, the Black radio stations, the Black papers. We still have some of our Black papers. But, I just say that that's kind of the bustling thing that people remember that was able to happen. And so as people became displaced, it's harder to connect with one another, right? It's easier, like, you know, what I was mentioning about, you know, the barista who is in a band, to just walk over to your friend's house and who's making beats and then, you know, just do rhymes. And
yes.
But if they are moved up to Everett and you're in Renton, that's harder to do, right?
Right.
And so there's kind of this cultural fluidity that is that we've lost as a byproduct of displacement. Which is why we think our work is important, right? Because people are longing for that connection that they had when the neighborhood was more Black, for lack of a better way.
Right? No, and the project is like this combination, Wanawari. We're talking to Elisheba Johnson, who's a member of the executive cohort of Wanawari, which is a home in the Central District in Seattle that has been kind of taken over and repurposed, but also it is important that it's real estate, right? It's important that it's a fifth generation home of Black people in Seattle. It's like it's an anchor in that sense, which, you know, is kind of it has this, like a great piece of art, you know, it kind of responds. I've you know, learned so much about it, but I've never learned where the name Wanawari comes from or what that is. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So like I said, it's Inye Wakoma's family home. And it's his family home on his mother's side, but his father is Nigerian. And so Wanawari literally means our home in the Southern Kalabari language of Nigeria. And we thought that was kind of a perfect metaphor, because it's not only just his family home, our family home, and his extended family, but also it's a community home. So it means all of that. Yeah.
So we're preserving it.
And I appreciate what you said about the land and the property, because it's true. This project is some ways a land use, and it's an anti-displacement project that operates as an art project. So it's vitally important to us to really understand how art, like I said, can be a way to stop displacement. And so one part of our work, we call it CASE. The central area, I always screw up the name. I'm not good with acronyms, but it's CASE 21. You can go to our website, wanawari.org. And what we realized is, how do we scale up the model, right? So if we can have this art center that helps this family keep their home, are there other ways that art can help other families keep their homes? Mm-hmm. So we're launching a survey, long-term survey work between Black cultural workers and Black homeowners, to really find out what their needs are, so that we can advocate for policy or do matchmaking, right? Like, maybe there's a Black homeowner who their kids have moved out, they have a large house, and maybe an artist can use one of those rooms as a studio space or something like that. So it's really an investigation about ways that we could look at helping folks with their property taxes, right? So to your point, some of those other housing issues that have contributed historically, it's been harder for people of color to get home improvement loans and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. So those are some of the pressures, too, that have led for people to sell their homes instead of, because it's just been hard to maybe keep up with the upkeep or the property taxes. And so we want to look at all those historical racialized pressures that people are under and figure out if there's ways that art can be a response to them.
I love it. So we got about 5 minutes left. We're talking to Elisheba Johnson, who's a member of the executive cohort of Wanawari, which is what we've been talking about, an amazing combination of both artistic statements and sociopolitical statements. And one of the things that interested me that I didn't really get backgrounded on, that I wanted to ask you about, is why there's four members of the executive cohort, and two are people of color, yourself included, and then two are white people. And why is that important?
That's a good question. Well, you know, it's interesting because we all started working together, and we all have our own interesting histories, right? So we've talked a lot about Inye, because his family has five generations of history in that neighborhood. I grew up in Seattle. I'm born and raised, and my parents were transplants here, and that we started going to the biggest black church in the city, really in the region, Mount Zion, which is in the Central District. And people my age and older, you have some, in a lot of ways, somebody has some connection to Mount Zion. It was such an anchor in the community. So a lot of my memories are every Sunday in the Central District and hanging out and doing a lot of my social activities that way. Rachel Kessler, when she bought her first home, it was in the Central District, and she really started understanding, trying to unpack when she got there and learning about her black neighbors and the community, and then started doing her own research and realized that her family, when it immigrated to the U.S., actually immigrated to Yesler's Way.
Whoa.
And she almost lived very close to that. And her family, actually, her great-grandfather, I believe, she's going to kill me if I get this wrong, is one of the original people who started the synagogue that is now Langston Hughes Performing Arts Center. So she kind of had this, like, inherent, you know, intuitive sense to kind of move to the Central District and then realize she has her own history there. Because, like I said, that neighborhood has all these different ethnicities and cultural memory that lives there. And then Jill Friedberg also lives in the Central District, but started a project that's really incredible called the Shelf Life Community Story Project. And that project is when Vulcan bought the promenade, the 23rd Promenade, and the Red Apple grocery store that had been there for decades was another community anchor. And she saw this was a really incredible opportunity to start gathering really important oral histories. So Vulcan, I think, gave her for free this old Starbucks space that was right next door. And for over a year and a half, her and a cadre of folks gathered over 70 oral histories. So we all have our own connections, and we work really well together, but we're very intentional about... So Jill and Rachel are very interested in what it means as white women to kind of do this work, right? This decolonizing, anti-supremacy, anti-displacement work. And then obviously me and Inye as black people have a much different relationship to it. And we're an executive cohort because we are also trying to understand for ourselves, how do you deconstruct all of these systems that are problematic, right? You have one executive director who holds all this work, and so if it's successful, you know, they have a really great personality and people love them. And then as they cycle out, sometimes people don't like the new ED and things like that. And we were like, what does it mean for us to all share power and share responsibilities? And then as people come up, we can mentor them into an executive director role, and then people can cycle out, right? So they are very much, you know, in the next couple of years want to cycle out, and we're going to have, you know, people of color, black folks in those roles. But I also think it's really interesting and important for white folks to know that they can do this work. They have a role in this work. It just looks different than what my role is.
Yeah. No,
that's a long-winded answer.
No, that's a great answer. That's exactly the answer I wanted. And we're right on time. And, you know, you don't sound like a shy arts administrator trying to change the world. You sound like somebody who's actually changing the world. And I really appreciate you taking, you know, time to be with us. And I hope we can actually have you back and get more updates because there's so much more to talk about. One more question before I let you go. It'll be fast. But what are the best ways that white people can support black and people of color, BIPOC artists, especially fine artists, or not especially, but including, other than just buying stuff? You know, how do we learn how to make space for voices that have traditionally been silenced in Seattle and everywhere?
There's some really great folks organizing. I think there's CARW, which is like the Center for Anti-Racist White, is a great place to start. Because I think sometimes it's getting together with white folks and unpacking, like, you know, their stuff is a great place to go. Of course, you can always, I know you said you, other than this, but you can go to wanawari.org and donate to our
organization. Oh, yeah, no, do that. Give money, money. Reparations are love.
But also, but people can also donate. We have experts in land use and things like that that are working for us pro bono, which is really incredible. So if you have any expertise around real estate, land use, hit us up on our email, our contact page. As we are doing this organizing work around Case 21, there'll be lots of ways for people to plug in and use their expertise to leverage for the resistance.
For the resistance. So, yeah. Well, thank you so much, Ilisheva Johnson, for being with us here today and for all the work that you
thank
do.
You,
oh, it's good to talk to you, and we'll talk more soon. And hopefully you'll just be our Seattle arts and justice and racial justice correspondent, okay?
Well, one of many. There's many.
Yeah, but you'll be ours for filter here on KPTZ. We'll get some other voices in there too. I'm sorry it's an unpaid position, but you know, at some point, who knows? But thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
We'll see you later.